Welcome to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times, a podcast for the progressive football coach, the inquisitive mind, and the lifelong learner for all things football, with your host, John Townsend.
Welcome to the Coaches Forum podcast hosted by These Football Times. Today's guest is a gentleman by the name of Jess Ibrahim. Jess is a British coach who's based in New Zealand. For the past 20 years, Jess's experience has taken him all over the world in a variety of different roles. He is the holder of the UEFA A license and a US Soccer A license. And we talk about player identification, talent identification, and all the ins and outs of what that process entails for a professional level coach. And our discussion talks about his journey into becoming a coach and what that's done as he's explored the world through the lens and vehicle of football and coaching. So I really hope that you enjoyed this episode, and thank you, as always, for tuning in to the Coaches Forum hosted by These Football Times. Jess, how are you doing today?
I'm brilliant, John. Yep, great to connect, and again, thank you for the opportunity today. Really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you coming on. We actually were speaking a couple of weeks ago, and the world's a much different place than we're all probably used to in the coaching world and in general. I think the times that we find ourselves in are quite challenging, and so it's good to talk to coaches who have such a robust level of expertise and experience and have been all over the world and are doing this thing we call coaching from a few different perspectives. And so someone like yourself who's got a robust level of experience, we'll get into that during the conversation. It's good to have you on. So what I think is important to maybe start with is I'm always interested to see where people decide to become coaches or how they fall into it or how is it manifest in their lives. And I'm very interested in people's coaching journeys because I think each one is unique. Each one is circumstantial. So where did your coaching journey begin? And were you a player? Kind of give us a little insight into your upbringing and your background in football, and then steer us toward where that coaching journey took place initially. And then we'll get into the evolution of yourself as a coach, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no worries. So for me, obviously, I had aspirations when I was a young boy, a young player in England. Like a lot of young players in England, that you're going to be a professional footballer. The reality of that is very, very different as you become older and you realise that there's a lot of competition in the UK. There's a number of professional clubs and some, you know, outstanding players that you're competing with, you know, every week. So quickly realized that I wasn't going to be up to the level of professional player. So the next best thing for me was coaching. And pretty much all by chance that the opportunity came about in the year 2000. A good friend of mine went out to the United States and he spent some time out near Boston coaching at varying levels from grassroots all the way up. And he put me in contact with a coaching company in the United States. And that really kickstarted the journey for me. So that was really my first initial experience of getting into coaching at a real practical level at a young age. So I went over to the US in the year 2000 and I spent the best part of 5 years over there. Played a little bit, but primarily my day-to-day was coaching. And so I was very fortunate. I coached at varying levels, again, from the juniors all the way up to college level throughout the northeastern side of the United States, Boston, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, you know, and a massive, lots of different experiences. And it was incredible for me to gain that experience at such a young age because you accumulate a lot of coaching hours and you experience a lot of different soccer environments, and as a result of that, that really lit the fire in me that, you know, I wanted to make football a full-time career. So came back to the UK in the year 2000 and spent the best part of 6 years there gaining my coaching licenses, and then wanted the next step to be abroad again. And that's probably where I find myself today, going on a bit of a nomadic journey as a coach through lots of different countries and parts of the world to where I find myself in New Zealand now.
So initially, I mean, this is a very important thing that we talked about on the phone a couple of weeks ago, is the idea of experiencing different cultures. And so your initial experience is abroad as a coach. What challenges did you find culturally from growing up in the UK, seeing the level of play there, and then what you knew, and then coming to a country in the United States that perhaps the game is less developed and less refined? Youth soccer is a massive thing here. It's just not, I think that there are some unique challenges. And for me as an American, I can understand them. I can only imagine for somebody coming in and getting their first experiences in this role of coaching, you encountered some unique challenges. Can you explain maybe one or two of those as you initially got yourself accustomed to the role on the touchline instead of on the field?
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, when you grow up in the UK, the culture is all-consuming, 24/7 football, TV, radio, everything. It's newspapers. It's in your face, that's your day to day. That's your normal. And you know, coming out to the US, it was very, very different for me. Mass football, but probably more in a unstructured sense. So for me, that was probably one of my biggest challenges, because I was coming from the UK where, you know, I'd been in football environments, whether it be a player, and you're used to that level of structure within the environment. The framework of the session is very, very structured. And I'm not saying that's, you know, right or wrong, because there's, you know, there's research and arguments for and against. But that was very, very different for me. So when I came out to the US, I quickly came into experiences and environments where it was a lot less structured, but it was, you know, it was their normal. So I had to adapt. And, you know, for me in the US, certainly from my experience, there's a real strong can-do approach. There's a real heavy support system in place by parents who, you know, want to make sure their son or daughter is being exposed to as many different soccer opportunities as possible. And, you know, that was the element I really, really enjoyed. But certainly from the ability to adapt as much as what I could to a different culture and different football environments, which were probably, you know, less structured. And I'm going back now. Yeah, you know, I'm going back a few years to the year 2000. So, you know, the game isn't in a position of where it's in, not certainly now, with how much the game is booming and new MLS franchises and whatever else. So that was probably the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that there is a distinct difference between the coach of 2000 and the coaching requirements and I think the modern football coach, and kind of shifting gears here. What do you define as requirements for at least yourself in terms of the modern coach? I mean, you have such a deep level of experience that's taken you, like I said, all over the world. What do you feel like the modern football coach needs to have these days? And this could roll into different technologies, the platforms that we leverage from social media, the way we see the game from maybe a digital standpoint, as opposed to maybe how you grew up playing the game, or any of these other things that maybe the coaches that you admired and had or you learned from didn't have the access to. So I guess my question is, the modern football coach has a certain set of requirements. What's your take on what those requirements might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the game, as you mentioned, John, has changed tremendously. And, you know, it's a continuum. So it's changing every single day. I mean, if ever there was an example of being exposed to the mass amount of, media content that you've got available to you, it's at this time. And we've seen it even more so, webinars and conferences, everything's on, you know, everything's been online, so coaches are exposed to it a lot more. I certainly think for, you know, as a younger coach now, you know, going through my journey, is that it's very, very important that you expose yourself as much as possible to those elite challenging environments, because that's when you get really, really gain more experience, you know, to be a more proficient practical coach. Now, in terms of everything that's around it, all the support mechanisms, performance analysis, just an example, individual player monitoring, all these different elements, I think it's invaluable that you do have a lot more of a grasp in these different areas. And it doesn't matter what level you're working at, be it, you know, a junior youth soccer club to one of the top clubs in, you know, in Europe or wherever else, is that, you know, you need to have experiences in these different areas. And I think it's a given. I really, really do. And I think it's all about balance, and it's making sure that you as a coach can combine all your experiences and what you've gained along the way, you know, to give you that sort of confident, authentic, you know, look towards things that you're practically knowledgeable enough in all these different areas. And certainly for me, that's been a big challenge, and something I'm forever looking to upskill myself, you know, for each of the different roles that I've moved into.
No, I'm so glad you actually mentioned the balance aspect, because when I was coming through my journey from player into coach, I kind of fell into it. It was, you know, I was the oldest of a group that was inheriting a younger group of players, and I'd never wanted to be a coach, but I found myself being pulled to these training sessions, and I was having to depend heavily on, you know, what I knew as a player, but also what I didn't know as a coach, but I didn't have these tools. And I think every top level coach that I've ever spoken to and worked alongside and worked under has really hit this point where it's like, you still need to be able to put the cones down yourself. You still need to be able to know where the bibs go and take a training session and conceptualize it on paper or even in your head. So it's more of an educative thing, where it's not like you're depending on the iPad every time. You're not just using these tools. You are inherently and fundamentally able to transfer what you know onto that player pool. And I think that that's something that a lot of modern coaches, especially younger ones, one of the things I implore them to do is do those years like you did, maybe as a grassroots level coach, because you learn so much about yourself and about managing expectation and learning the game from that perspective as well. So one of the things that I have mentioned before is there's a crossover between coaching and education, and I think a lot of high-level coaches are really high-level educators, whether they're licensed or teachers or they're just certified in something, but they have this educative approach to their style. Do you find, as you've traveled throughout the levels and then the geographies, that how does a coach go through and go beyond simply instructing and telling and do what we consider as like this token term of coaching as direct instruction? So, you know, this could be like, you know, mastering the delivery of the message instead of just the content of it, or that whole phrase I think you and I were talking about, which is, it's not what you say, it's but what they hear. You know, how have you seen that navigated in realities that you've existed in throughout maybe the UK, here in the States, you know, in New Zealand, all over the place?
Yeah, I think it comes down to how adaptable you can be as a coach. And I've been fortunate to work in a number of different countries. And certainly when I went into those countries, very, very quickly, you anticipate that you have to adapt to the environment. You have to adapt to the people. And, you know, most importantly, you have to adapt to the culture as well. And I've certainly experienced and been fortunate to go through those experiences. If I give you one example, Cook Islands, where I was there for the best part of 2 years, very, very different culture, like every other country is different. And in terms of the way in which you may instruct a group there and practically, you know, put your points across as a coach within the session, and the content that you're looking to get across, it will probably be a lot more simplified than what it might well be if you was in the UK or even the US, where the game is a lot more developed. In terms of the actual delivery of the message as well, it's important that you know, as I mentioned before, it's very, very simplified. Now, as you go through different environments, certainly when I was in Mexico, it can be a lot freer and it can be a lot more, how should I say, within the flow of the session a lot more. So rather than that, you know, that usual, I guess, stop, stand still that you see in some football environments, which I've encountered, you know, it's very much within the flow of the session a lot more because, you know, that's how they respond to it more appropriately rather than, you know, stop or freeze, whatever it might well be, instruct, go live. And there's different ways in which you can adapt to it. But certainly for me, it's been a very much a learning journey in regards to that, but making sure that me as a coach adapt to those different environments and the way in which you deliver those key messages, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. I think especially somebody who has such a varied level of coaching from youth levels all the way up to the older levels, you can see how that also changes. When I was kind of talking about this aspect with Mike Keeney, the gentleman who put us in contact, one of my biggest questions, having played under Mike's coaching, was just that. How do you fit into these different schemas or these cultures and deliver your coaching in a way that player pool understands? And so I'm really glad that you brought up that experience in Mexico, which I really want you to expand on, because so often coaching is defined in these containerized, siloed areas where if you're not following what you did in the coaching course explicitly, you sometimes second guess, you know, your effectiveness or your quality as a coach. And I think your ability to be, I use the term amorphous, it's not that, but just adaptable, pliable. It's same as a player, you can fit into different systems and whatnot. What are your key experiences, which I really want to spend the bulk of our time talking about, is player analysis and talent identification. In other layman's terms, probably it comes down to scouting. Here in the States, scouting is still an emerging, true scouting, in my opinion, is an emerging industry or art or science, however you want to label it. Can you speak about your experiences around the world, but also gaining from what you learned as a coach and as a player, what true talent identification comes down to? And, you know, I think so often there's this strange approach where people think that it's a simple subjective assessment of player qualities or attributes. And my eyes were opened up heavily when I read Michael Calvin's book, The Nowhere Men. I'm not sure if you've read that book, but it is very interesting to see how the term and the art of player identification and talent identification manifests in modern football. Can you talk about your experiences and kind of take us on a journey and how you approach that task and what you've done with clubs?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most relevant example was Mexico. So when I was based in New Zealand, we were very fortunate. We worked alongside Chelsea and we would, in effect, we would operate a hub academy down in the South Island, New Zealand, but we'd actively recruit players globally. And you know, we'd bring those players in, we'd polish them up, we'd warehouse them as such, and then we'd move them on in an ideal world back to Chelsea. If not, they would go to other professional football clubs. And if it isn't, you know, it's into the US college system or somewhere else. And so I spent a lot of time traveling, mostly throughout Latin America and Southeast Asia. So when I had my experiences in Mexico, you know, very quickly you realize you're exposed to environments over there that are very, very different. You know, social status sort of dictates a lot to a degree. And, you know, you're right in the sense that we did have a, if I should say, a profile of a player that ideally we were looking for. We had a lukewarm criteria of the player that we're looking for. But in all honesty, you know, it's until you actually get into those environments, you feel those environments, you know, you speak to the players, you speak to the parents, you speak to the coaches, then you really, really get, you know, exposed a lot more in terms of, you know, what is the potential of these players. And for me, that's the most important ingredient, is the potential of where that player can actually go within their relevant pathway. And it's being in a position where you can maximize that potential, because you fully appreciate it. But when you see a player at 10, 11 years old, and if I use a player that I was that I identified from a small town in Mexico, Monclova, it was about 2.5 hours from Monterrey, and we run this big showcase event. We probably had five pitches going on at the same time and across five evenings. And my role as the talent spotter, I guess, was to go around all of those different pitches, identify potential players that had the ability and the potential whereby they could move up into the next level in the elite sense. So one player identified was a player called Eugenio Pesuto. And quickly evident that, you know, at 10, 11 years old, had a huge amount of potential for within his specific peer group. And so it was a player that, you know, I brought back to New Zealand. We worked within the club there, Wellington Phoenix at the time, when we moved, morphed over the Academy of Air. And then we moved him back to Mexico. Now he's under 17 national team player. He's just been in the national team, plays for Pachuca. So he's on a very, very good pathway. Now, at the time when I identified Eugenio, he was not the finished article. He was a player with huge potential, but there was a lot of elements within his game that needed improving, just in terms of, you know, I won't go into it, but in terms of the technical aspect, tactically would just come as he more matured, along with the physicality as well. So I guess for me is that when I went into these different environments, like in Mexico, and I spent a lot of time traveling around a lot of different cities and football clubs, is that there's huge amount of potential there and there's hotbeds of talent there. And the unfortunate thing for me is that a lot of these players, they don't get exposed to those high level opportunities, just probably down to more, you know, this social status of where they're currently at. But huge potential. So I guess in closing, really, John, in answer to your question, it has to relate to your environment. If you're a European football club and you have a set criteria and this is the profile to play that we're specifically looking for, then that will be set for you. But that's not to say that you can deviate off that path to find a player who, you know, has the potential but could go on and play at the highest level.
I have to imagine one of the most challenging aspects of player identification at that 10, 11 year old level is assessing that potential. Like, that's such an inexact science in so many ways. It's like, well, this is how they are, their peer group. What will they do when, you know, older, as you mentioned, those other things come in, the tactics, the physicality. How do you, you know, assess or judge your own core beliefs and principles when you approach this task? Because I think part of it has to do with, you know, your philosophy as a coach as well. It's like, you know, this is what I feel the game, how it should be played. Or, you know, maybe you've been given a task to go find something for another coach. But in any event, you're still probably falling back on certain philosophical aspects that lend themselves to seeing the diamond in the rough, so to speak, but really just seeing the practical applications of a player's output. I think that that is one of the most challenging things, is to see, you know, it's not so much where they're at now, but where that trajectory has got an upward tick. How do you balance your core beliefs and principles with that, with such a I guess a young age?
Yeah, I mean, it's you mentioned it just at the beginning, actually, is that the moment that player comes into your environment, that's the moment where, time is ticking straight away and you're looking to maximize the potential of that player immediately. Now, the next stage to that is exposing that player to, in my philosophy and values and beliefs, is exposing that player to as many different challenging environments as possible and situations. And so with Eugenio, as an example, when we brought him to New Zealand, and I think he's a 2000 2002 or 2003 date of birth, we would expose him within the environment, challenging him in lots of different situations, certainly within a physicality way, in terms of him coming up against players that were probably 2, 3, in some cases 4 years older than him. But knowing that he would get exposed, knowing that he would find it a challenge, whether it's in a just a physical athletic standpoint as an example. And that would come into games, that would come into exposing him within the game in areas of the pitch, positions whereby he wasn't comfortable, and knowing that that would be a real increased level of challenge for him as a constant. Because at the end of the day, whenever you're moving a player on as a coach, or you're always going to move that player into a different environment, and that player will go with a different coach, and that coach's values and beliefs will probably be different to you or I. So for me, it was very much the moment that player comes into the environment, you're looking to expose them, you're looking to accelerate their development as quickly as possible, and really, really focusing on those key areas that are really going to challenge him in the short term to really maximize his potential in the long term.
Yeah, there's been instances where a player's come when I was working with an academy. I was coming on a trial, and there's like that aha moment, like then it fades. And then there's in the natural ebb and flow of a player's form, and you know, whether it's confidence, whether it's competition, and all these things that go together. But one of the bigger challenges that I can imagine, and I'd like you to speak to this a little bit, is the psychology of a young player. I think, you know, you get into those teenage years and the adolescence, it just, everything's a mess. You know, there's certain types of, like one of my experiences as a player was I played up several years as a young age, more out of lack of options, but it helped my development, but it did not help my maturity at all. Actually, I was so used to playing against players that were bigger, stronger, more talented, meaner. And so at the end of the day, I would develop into this, I'd assume an identity as a player. And then when I was at a certain point, I didn't know how to manage that. I think today's player, the psychology of a young player, and a young person, how do you see, maybe you can use the example of this player you've been talking about, but you know, do you see where that starts to really affect the footballing side? Because I know it's really this dichotomy for me where it's like, you know, if a player is, you know, out of control in the classroom, out of control at home, but then you get them on the football pitch and all of a sudden it's just kind of things fall in the place. How do you see that? How do you approach that side of it? Or do you at all as a scout?
Yeah, I think it's a huge component for me. And it's very important that, you know, when you're identifying these players, you're getting as much background on that player as well, as much as possible. You know, what is their family environment like? You know, what's their school like? How are they with their school teachers? You know, what are they like within their present football club? How do they come across in terms of personality, their attitude towards everything, training, games, and everything off the pitch as well? How they apply themselves within the classroom, you know, all of these different elements, I think, are very, very, very important. And I'm a big believer in that. They go hand in hand. So you have to marry the two up as quickly as possible. And, you know, you're almost doing a profile check on that player initially when they're coming in with you within the environment. And certainly when, if I use El Hunio as an example, whereby when we brought him into New Zealand, you know, his family traveled with him. They, you know, let him settle into the environment. You know, his academics was always in line with his football, and you know, the discipline and the approach you take it towards, you know, actually applying yourself within the classroom, for me, is always reflected in the actual football environment as well. They go hand in hand. You know, you can't apply yourself in one area and not in the other. And so it's really, really important that as much as possible that, you know, you are monitoring, you're managing that player. And certainly with the support that players have around them now in terms of the sports psychology of whether it's on an individual basis, whether it's in a, you know, a classroom setting, for me, it's a really, really important attribute because you've just got so much available to you now. Why would you not expose yourself to those different situations that ultimately could help you along your pathway and give you that support along the way?
No, I agree. I think that, I mean, I have a young nephew who plays out in Phoenix, and the tools at his disposal are yeah. immense compared to previous generations. But it's almost like an overload. I can imagine just having all these different inputs. What are some, and get more in the specifics here, what are some traits, or getting really into the nuts and bolts of this, what do you see as some of the areas of a young player's game, let's say, that 10 to 13 range that you find to be most efficient in terms of, you know, maybe the technical aspects of it, maybe it's their ability to, you know, receive across their body and, you know, or be, you know, comfortable playing in a different formation. What are some things that you see with young players, especially that you've one identified and you see kind of universally? And then also what I'm getting to is there's a certain threshold where I feel young players, if they don't have a certain skill set developed or at least challenged enough and helped along the way, that they leave it too late. If that makes any sense, do you have anything that you could identify? And it doesn't have to be, you know, receiving across the body or being able to use both feet, but I think that there's a certain fundamental level that comes with a special talent that if not nurtured at a certain point, it's a bit of a challenge going forward. And I'm not saying that late bloomers aren't everywhere. We see them. They're wonderful stories, but what are some traits that you see?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with you 100%. You know, some players, certainly the more talented players from those particular ages, the 10 to 13, will have their own unique skill set. And, you know, I think it's an area that can obviously continue to be improved upon. I think from those ages as well, that players are really going through a lot of different, you know, growth cycles. And, you know, that will impact certainly on them from a technical standpoint, tactical standpoint, where we'll be out, you know, have they got the athletic ability that they might have had at 10 years old? Now at 12 years old, they haven't got that ability to get around a football pitch like they did before. But it's really, really focused on that skill set that you can really enhance as much as possible, because I think these are the fundamental years. These are the years where, you know, contact on the ball is paramount importance. And, you know, well, for me is that whenever I identify a player, they come within the environment, I almost spend more time focused on the areas of the game that they need to improve upon. So Elhunio was a prime example, predominantly left-footed player, technically very, very proficient within his left side. So he could play abundance of positions on the left-hand side of the football field. His skill set was outstanding on that side of the field. His individual player actions were very, very good. However, the areas that he needed to improve upon, and it was quickly evident, you know, based upon our player profile and the criteria we had for each individual player, is that the areas that he needed to focus on was his right side, his ability to, as you say, take the ball across his body within his right side, open the game up, drive off his right foot, you know, turn off his right foot, cross off his right foot with elevated power on the ball, shoot in a coordinated way rather than just swinging his right leg towards the ball. Because at the end of the day, the players who want to play at the elite level, and we're talking the top level, is that they have to have, for me, all of these different skill sets, but not predominantly on one side of the body or something that are more favoured on than not. You know, you have to have the ability to be able to work off both feet in a coordinated way, in a natural way, you know, which is going to set you apart and which will make you more comfortable within the elite football environments that you're training in, and ultimately, hopefully, you're going to be playing in as well.
It's an incredible way to say it. And I think one of the lessons that I've tried to convey to young players is the idea of consistency and performing on a consistent level. And I think as a as a young player and as you're assessing talent, maybe the oscillation between, you know, good and bad games or what they perceive as a good or bad game. And I always say, you know, was it a bad game or was it 10 minutes that you milked for 90 minutes? And that's one of the things that is challenging. Have you observed anyone who's maybe been at the highest level, maybe, you know, at a Premier League club, I think you mentioned Chelsea or even in the States and MLS, that was able to take the message or the player profile that they'd given to you and then, or that they'd stipulated and then take it to the next level? Like how's that transition work out for those of us who've never experienced it?
Yeah, I'll probably say who, you know, there's a few players. And again, I've like a lot of coaches, I played a part in their journey. Bill Tuoloma, who is actually played in the US Portland Timbers, and he plays for the New Zealand national team as well. So Bill was a player who very quickly was exposed to a lot of different elite environments at a very, very young age. We would actively send him overseas for experiences. So he had those experiences, Tottenham Hotspur, Chelsea, you know, 16, 17 years old. To the point when he was 17, he was training with Beckham at the Galaxy on a regular basis, playing within their academy system there. Ended up signing with Olympique Marseille for, I believe, 2-3 years, and now he's plying his trade in the top flight of football in the United States. And the difference with Bill is that he did have a skill set, a fundamental basic skill set, but it was areas that he needed to improve upon. He was a real strong early developer within his peer group, but he carried it on, and he ended up going beyond, you know, his current peer group at the time as well. So he really, really challenged himself on a daily basis to expose himself in those situations. He had a very measured approach in terms of the way in which he would train. Not outwardly confident, I'd say, not back then anyway. But was very, very self-assured, and he was self-assured. He had a very, very strong mentality, strong work ethic. And I don't know what it is, but I think it does revert back to the sort of Kiwi psyche, I guess, to a degree, is that there's a number of New Zealand players that apply and trade abroad, and they seem to adapt to these situations a lot easier in terms of going into a environment in a different country in Europe, and they adapt to it a lot easier than what other players would do, I guess. And for Bill, he was one of those players. He had a fundamental characteristic of a player who could play at the top level, but needed a lot of polishing, work, and he really, really challenged himself to get himself onto that pathway as quickly as possible. But, you know, very, very, very strong mentality. So now you see it. You know, he plays predominantly central defender for the Timbers, I think. And, you know, he's very assured. He's very assured at that level of the game. And he seems to have found his niche here as well.
Maturation has to be, like, the maturity level of a player has to be probably the hardest thing to harness or to cultivate in so many ways. I've seen players who have all the skill in the world, but they're, you know, their ability to adjust to different coaches or different delivery methods or different levels of competition internally within a club have really been roadblocks. And I think that you just mentioned, you know, this aspect of people or players from New Zealand being able to integrate really well. Do you think that comes from their upbringing, their education, or is it a cultural aspect of, you know, knowing that there's a rich sporting tradition and a, you know, a culture of competition at a young age? Where do you think that comes from, especially with regards to people and players from New Zealand?
Yeah, I think there's a few different aspects. I mean, culturally, very much so, definitely. New Zealand is on a whole. I mean, don't hold me to this. I think it's close to 5 million in terms of population. And there's a lot of very, very talented sportswomen and sportsmen that are not just within New Zealand representing New Zealand, but also abroad in lots of different sports. And they are at the top level of sports. You know, New Zealand's produced so many different talented sports people that have gone on and had a real global impact. You know, and I see it all the time. I do a lot of research in and around, you know, these different sports women and men that have gone abroad, not just in a footballing sense, but in lots of different sports as well. I think paddleboarding, stand-up paddleboarding, we've got the world champion female paddleboarder, and she has been for something like 6-7 years. She comes from New Zealand. Now, how she's gone on that journey is, you know, it's down to her upbringing. It's down to the environment that she's been exposed to as much as possible. I think New Zealand as a climate, you know, is very good. And I think, you know, unlike a country like Iceland 20 years ago, whereby they were probably only playing outdoors 4 or 5 months of the year due to the climate, and now that's changed with, you know, the way in which they've developed the game over there and the structures they've got in place. So climate is a big thing for me, but just I think it's just a Kiwi psyche, is that they can handle those situations. And it never ceases to amaze me in terms of just the players that have gone abroad from New Zealand, and, you know, they're adapting to the environment with ease. Kiwis are quite easygoing. They can adapt to different environments, and now is probably the time where there's the most female and male players that are playing actually abroad outside of New Zealand in some of the top leagues around the world.
I read a book maybe a year and a half ago by James Kerr, Legacy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, great book.
But yeah, I mean, just what is what the All Blacks can teach us about the business of life. And I think the first chapter is like sweep the shed and just, you know, the pride of your personal environment, of respecting the environment and the attention to detail. And, you know, my upbringing, you know, when I was a young boy in the Netherlands, that was another thing, which was, you know, the attention to detail is such an important cultural aspect of Dutch culture, and it seems to be in Kiwi culture as well. And another great aspect of this is I watched another program, I think it's All or Nothing, is about the All Blacks. But I think we sometimes forget that there is a humility that goes along with being a good player and being a good coach. And that humility sometimes is lost on this idea of winning at all costs, or an idea of excellence that is very hard to maintain. And you've have a unique journey in the game in terms of your education and your certification. You've gone through the English FA, you've gone through the U.S. Soccer Federation license program, and in UEFA as well, I think. How can you, I guess, what have you learned through your getting your UEFA A license through the English FA, and then getting your, you know, U.S. Soccer Federation A license through USSF? You know, what types of challenges and things were you exposed to that, you know, from two different educational systems, did you find that you gained the most from? And I'm not saying what was better. I'm just saying, what did you gain from each route?
Yeah, I'd say certainly with through the English FA, being exposed to an environment where you're with top professionals working at the top level within the game, not just within England, but Europe as well. And it's been around some very, very elite coach educators. I was fortunate through my UEFA A license. I had the late Dick Bate, who, you know, had such an instrumental effect on coach education, not just in England, but around the world as well. And for me to be in that environment, for me to be exposed to people like him, I've still got things that I take with me today. You know, I've still got elements within my coaching makeup that were, you know, implemented, you know, on that course via Dick and the other lead coach educators. Big challenge, huge challenge. And it exposed all the areas within, you know, my coaching makeup that I needed to improve upon. And, you know, that was a very humbling experience, if I'm being honest. And, you know, you quickly realize that, you know, coaching, the coaching world, the coaching industry is huge. You know, there's going to be people working harder than you even now at any one time to get ahead of other people. It's a very competitive industry as well. So you've got to be willing to go through a lot of adversity. And, you know, certainly from my experience on the UEFA A license, you know, that's what it felt. It was the toughest, most challenging course. I'd been on, I think it was something like 16 days was the part one. You know, you're doing presentations at 8:30 in the morning. You're getting back to your hotel room at 9:30 at night. You're carrying on another presentation or pre-course task. It's nonstop. So then it swung round to the US A license. And for me, I really, really wanted to go into a different environment, different culture, expose myself to a different learning methodology, coach education framework. And the US in a completely different way was really, really beneficial to me. I connected with some amazing people who I still keep in contact with today. A different way of delivery from the lead US coach instructors. Something I was, you know, not used to as well. And, you know, certainly areas that I felt, you know, that I got great benefit from as well. And, you know, I'd done my B license in the US and immediately I'd done my A license, I think 2 years later. I got straight back on the same course, went to Phoenix, Arizona, you know, one after the other. And I loved it, enjoyed the experiences so much. To a degree, I'll do a similar experience now. And I'm actually looking for that as well in a different country. Because I think as a coach, it's not enough now just to sit on what you know. And what I mean by that is, you know, you have to expose yourself to different environments because it will make you a more adaptable coach in person when you move into your next role, wherever it might well be.
So that point about not resting on your badges, and I think that it is tempting because you work so hard to go through that ladder and get all this knowledge and then use it. How do you define this journey where you're now in New Zealand? What is your current role and what challenges and triumphs are you currently encountering as you, you know, share your experiences and use your expertise in that corner of the world?
Yeah, so I just finished the season with Tasman United, who play in the top tier of the National League here in New Zealand. I was director of football and head coach, and it was a huge challenge in a completely different way. Redefine the environment, develop a culture, and, you know, look to implement some key principles on the pitch as well. And it resulted in us having a successful season, you know, for Tasman United. We finished the highest we've ever finished in the franchise, had some very, very favourable results that I'd never had in history as well. So there are some highlights for me. And for me, you know, I wanted to go into a different environment where it was another challenge. I seem to find myself certainly in the last three roles where I've gone into, you know, these different environments whereby I know it's going to be a challenge, and it's going to be a challenge from the outset. And it's going to be something that if I want to have any level of success, whatever it might well look like for that particular club or organization, is that, you know, I've got to be willing to myself as much as possible. And it certainly was. So there are some good highlights for me. For me now, an opportunity to reflect as much as possible, focus on those areas that I need to improve upon, which I have been doing, whether it's online learning, because obviously that's the world which we're currently in, and really focusing on, you know, not just as areas that I can improve upon, but also, you know, what area do I want to move into next, you know, and what, in an ideal world, in the future, what region do I want to work in, you know, next as well. So yeah, that's me really, really reflecting as much as possible and focusing on, you know, the areas I want to improve upon and my future as well, I guess.
So how is this, I mean, this is a pretty current question, but how is this quarantine period really helped you grow your level of learning, or what has it maybe challenged you with in terms of going beyond the obvious? You can't, you know, get out there and coach the players, or maybe some sectors of the world can, but to this point, what has this period that every coach finds him or herself in really stressed or pushed you to improve upon as you ready yourself for the next step?
Yeah, I mean, reflection is a big thing for me. Speaking to peers that I trust about my different experiences and my coaching pathway. I've been very, very proactive because I think you have to be. And, you know, it's given me the opportunity to connect with new people within my industry and reconnect with people within the industry that, you know, primarily probably didn't have the time to do that. And for a lot of people as well. So for me, that has been hugely beneficial. Me working on my own individual brand. And what I mean by that is that, you know, what does Jess Ibram as a coach actually stand for? And, you know, how do I want to make sure that I'm, you know, portraying myself across when I move into my, or where I prepare moving into my next role as well. Focusing on the online learning as much as possible. And there's a lot of different content and platforms that you can get that from. I think it'll be even more so now. And I think people are going to readapt, certainly how they approach their day-to-day life and job. I think we're going to move probably out of a world where it's, you know, it's all going to be reliant on being in within the office workspace. I think people are going to, I think you're going to be seeing a lot more online content out there, which will be great. Because, you know, when you're on the move quite a lot, you know, it enables you to keep upskilled as much as possible. But certainly for me is focusing on those different areas that I want to improve upon, those different areas I want to actually gain more insight on. There's so much content out there at this moment in time, and it's really making sure that, you know, you're filtering it as much as possible, because there is so much of it that, you know, you want to make sure that you're getting the most relevant content you can that's going to benefit you.
Yeah, I think this has been both a blessing and a curse in so many ways, because there are so many great resources out there and there's only so many hours in the day. And I mean, time is what we have at the moment, but
yeah,
I think, you know, my own personal philosophy is it changes every so often. It tweaks, it doesn't change. It's just there's refinements. How would you characterize or define or summarize your own personal coaching philosophy? And it doesn't have to be anything, you know, too in depth, but, you know, what are your core beliefs as you move into this next stage and get ready for whatever is around the corner?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me is that I have core beliefs and principles that I've carried from, you know, when I was in the UK. And certainly when I came back from the US, it was great in the sense that it accumulated all this experience. Certainly when I went back to the UK in 2005, then, you know, I had some real strong key principles of how I wanted my environments to look like when I was working within those environments, in terms of the structure of the organization, the structure of the club, and my coaching philosophies are born out of that. And so, you know, I'm very much a believer in that. For me, the environment, you know, has to have a good framework to the way in which it operates, coming down to the actual session content itself, very detailed in the way in which I approach my work, structured in the sense of structured, but not being able to adapt as and when, you know, I feel like it, but very disciplined within the environment. And because you want to maximize, you know, the player's time that you've got available. And certainly when I was here in Tasman, we would have 4 contacts with the players a week. You're understanding they have a life outside of the football. They're amateur footballers, semi-professional footballers. And, you know, they've got jobs, they've got lives, social lives outside as well. So really, I make sure that I maximize that time as much as possible within the environment. And certainly the, you know, my core principles, although I've adapted the way in which I might deliver those key messages and the practical elements within the coaching session, I still come back to my strong beliefs in terms of, you know, how I want the environment to look like, the respect I want it to come across, the attitude of the players. And yeah, you know, that's taken me on this journey, and I'm not sure where it's going to take me next, if I'm being honest.
That's okay. There's a an odd debate that, you know, do systems define players or do players define systems? And I always ask coaches this because I'm interested to see what they say, but it is reassuring to hear that you have these core tenets that you don't really waver from. You modify, you evolve, but you don't just flip the script based on, you know, where you are in the world and the players. You try to carry some of that with you. And you don't have to answer that question because I think it's a kind of ridiculous question.
No, I agree. You know, for me, just from my experience, is that, you know, the players dictate the system. You know, they don't dictate in terms of telling the coach how they want to play this particular system, but, you know, we had a system here at Tasman United whereby, you know, we were very, very defence minded. I don't need to get into detail, but we were very defence minded in the way in which we approached the game, very hard working, combative, competitive, and we'd look to counter attack teams. Now, there's teams, franchises in the league that were completely different. 4-3-3, 3-5-2, expansive football, overloading, but they had the players, you know, available to do that. I didn't. So, you know, if I moved into a different environment, I'm sure it would probably be different. As it is with, say, Pep at Manchester City and, you know, a coach working in League Two in English football.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge that a coach who has not seen the professional game or worked in a professional environment is... The top coaches and top teams make it look so simple, and when you strip away all the bells and whistles, you realize just how much work goes into that final product. And I always am amazed to see how people tend to think that what you see on the screen happens in a session or two, and it's really a collective. It's an army of people working toward an ideal outcome. You did mention one thing that I kind of want to end on, which is, you know, these people have lives away from the game. So what other things do you do to keep busy, especially when this game can be all consuming? Coaching can really, you know, fill every pocket of time. What are some things that, you know, maybe you get away from the game to detach or to decompress that you do to kind of keep yourself sharp or at least sane?
Yeah, I think as I've got older, I've become more experienced and wiser in the sense of as much as you give the game, and I give 100% whichever role that I'm in, you have to get some form of balance. And I think it's important because, you know, then it enables you to be more productive in your work within your day to day. And so for me, I'm very fortunate, you know, currently living in New Zealand. You know, this climate is amazing. I have the opportunity, I'm out on my road bike pretty much every day. I enjoy other different sporting codes and following different sporting codes. I've become more and more you know, ingrained and in, you know, enriched in those different experiences, you know. So even while I've been in New Zealand, I've gone into other different sporting codes and, you know, actively follow those sporting codes as well. But I think it's finding, you know, that switch off point. You have to, because everyone's lives are busy, and for you to really, really maximize your day to day, you need to make sure that, you know, that you're having that time away for yourself. And, you know, it could just be going for a coffee. You know, I you know, that's my Achilles heel, is I do drink a lot of coffee. And, you know, I do in New Zealand, is a, you know, is a bit of a long standing joke. You can never be, you know, 20 meters away from a coffee shop because, you know, it's coffee central. So, you know, for me, I just love going out to a coffee shop, you know, having a coffee, connecting with a few people around the world, I'm fortunate to know. But again, the game is always on your mind, but if you give it everything all the time, certainly when you're in a competition element, then, you know, at a point you will hit your breaking point. So, it's just trying to get that balance as much as possible. But I think that comes through experience as you get older.
Oh, I've learned that lesson the hard way, especially when kids came into the picture, is taking time for yourself. And I was telling you a couple of weeks ago how as soon as I stopped playing, I had to find another input, which was I just took a distance running just because it was like, well, I'll stay fit, but I'll be able to not be a, not be a, an employee, not be a coach, and just be a person on the road. And that was really important to me. So to wrap up here, what, how could people connect with you if they wanted to do so via online platforms or social media? Do you have any of those that you'd like to share, at least the easiest ones to get a hold of you if listeners want to connect?
Yeah, I'll probably say, well, the only one I've really got active is LinkedIn. So, you know, very much, yeah, coaches are more than welcome to connect with me, you know, and, you know, have a chat. We can collaborate together and, you know, just it'll be great. You know, I was, you know, I get a whole bunch of messages from people regularly, and it's always good to speak with people from different parts of the world who are going through their own challenges. One thing you realize is that the football world is a very, very small industry. It's very, very small. Everyone seems to know everyone. And so for me, yeah, no, LinkedIn is probably the best means to contact, and then, you know, you can go from there.
Perfect. Thanks again for listening to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times. Talking to people like Jess really makes putting this podcast together for other coaches and learners and disciples of football really, really worthwhile. In the meantime, while we wait for leagues to start back up and coaching to resume in our own ecosystems, I invite everybody to go check out thesefootballtimes.co for the latest and greatest long-form journalism on the web, and check out the magazine editions of These Football Times. There's a number of digital editions. There's the best print football magazines out there in the shop, and the writers that I am honored to write alongside and to associate myself with do an amazing job of putting this thing together, and I think it's a gift to the football world. So please check out the magazine, please check out the other podcasts, check out the website. I know there's a lot of new exciting things coming or just around the corner from These Football Times, and it's an honor to be part of this production. And to you, the listener, thanks again for spending some time with us, and until next time, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times. Be sure to check out These Football Times online for some of the best long-form, authentic journalism and football storytelling on offer.